The Watch is the latest and the greatest in pop culture from best friends Chris Ryan and Andy Greenwald. Join them as they discuss TV, movies, music, and much more. Check out The Watch on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
David, this weekend I read James Crumley's private eye novel, The Last Good Kiss, and I loved it. What I want to know is, why didn't you tell me about this book sooner?
I can't believe I never told you about this book. There are literally only, like, the only books that I ever, well, I say the only, like, mystery novels vaguely defined that I ever, like, hand to people in physical copies are The Last Good Kiss and Daniel Woodrell's, the Bayou trilogy, the Bayou trilogy collection is freaking amazing.
You didn't hand it to me though.
I know. I think I don't know when he appeared in my life. Crumley, but he is just absolutely the best. And that trilogy, I think loosely, it's a loose trilogy, is just fantastic. Crumley is, sentence for sentence, just one of the great writers of all time. It's so good. You know, they tried to make a TV show of that with Paul Giamatti, I think right before Billions or something. It's so good. But yes, I know we talk about this all the time, but for the record, I mean, most of the people that I'm reading are so sort of like baked into the fabric of, well, every used bookstore you go into that it's sort of beside the point for me to mention them. But there's all the oldies, right? Like everybody has read like James M. Cain, and sure, Jim Thompson is sort of unavoidable. I love Jim Thompson to death, but he's sort of unavoidable. And everybody, I think a lot of people have like like Chris and Andy love Ross McDonald. I'm like a John D. McDonald guy, although Ross McDonald is good. Those two are like in mass market paperbacks and, you know, competing for space. But if you don't read, I mean, if you want to read some good stuff, most of these are people who you've heard of, but Horace McCoy has a very special place in my heart. David Goodis, Cornel Woolrich, Chester Himes, but he's really famous. Charles Williford. I'm going down the list here. And there's like the modern ones, you know, George Pelicanos and Elmore Leonard is sort of beside the point. But those first names, just read all of that and then come back to me and we'll see if I forgot anything.
That's kind of a lot. David, by the way, will be roaming the aisles at the mystery bookstore this weekend. Yeah. If you need any further recommendations,
those
weren't enough.
I'm gonna send you a stack of books, so you'll never be able to ask me again why I didn't tell you about somebody.
Coming up on today's show, Donald Trump is back at CPAC. We discuss, plus here come these celebrity author coronavirus books. All that and more on the Press Box, a part of the Ringer Podcast Network. Hello, media consumers. Brian Curtis and David Shoemaker here. David, I regret to inform you that Donald Trump is back.
You're waiting for a big response there, because I don't know if I have one left.
It's kind of waiting for a sigh or a...
I thought we were beyond this. I thought we as a country had moved beyond...
No. we as a country may sort of be beyond this, but CPAC is definitely not beyond Donald Trump. And they invited him to speak on Sunday afternoon. A few amazing details before we get into the meat of Donald Trump's speech. And by the way, I don't want to say I've missed these because I have not missed Donald Trump being president, but remember when the news was just amazing details about things Donald Trump did?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that very well.
Yes, not the policies, not the ruinous policies, but just things that happen in the Oval Office between like 2 and 2:05 in the afternoon.
Yeah, or on the golf course or en route between the Oval Office and the golf course, yeah.
We got some of those on Sunday. First of all, Trump was an hour late to his speech. Now, that's not unusual for politicians, but conservative guy Matt Schlapp went on stage and pretended that Donald Trump wasn't late. Everything is going according to schedule, he said. Because if Donald Trump did something bad and everyone pretended he wasn't doing something bad, what's the worst that could happen?
It was a very, very weird situation, right? I mean, and I know that there was so much that we saw that was sort of evocative of, well, the era we just got out of. But I feel like that in itself was just that little obfuscation about where Trump was just a perfect little version of the previous 4 years where somehow the lie seems way more suspicious than the truth, right? I mean, like everybody was like on Twitter theorizing that John Marshall suggested that he might have saw like a process server on the way in, so they were ducking him by the door. I don't know how facetious he was being, but these sorts of rumors were popping up all over the place. And in fact, it was just he hadn't left his hotel until like well after the speech was supposed to begin.
When Donald Trump finally did arrive at CPAC, the New York Times' Aaron Schaff took this amazing picture. Did you see this? Donald Trump looking at himself backstage in a full-length mirror.
It's, wow.
Yeah. Kind of a flattering photo, as Donald Trump photos go, I must say.
It's hard to tell. Is that one of those, like, it's impossible to buy a mirror for your house, but there is that just one variety of, like, door-height skinny mirror that for some reason you can always get for $20? Is that what that is?
I think so. That every apartment in New York had. In the 2000s.
Isn't that one of the most shocking things about adulthood that mirrors cost like $100 and something to get?
Who knew? Last detail before we get to the speech, the Washington Post found a CPAC attendee carrying a sign that said, "Give Trump back the nuclear codes."
Wow.
Now, I know there are a lot of people that still want Donald Trump to be president that wish he had actually won the 2020 election, but do they really want Trump to have the nuclear codes?
I was saying, there's a lot of people out there that still believe Donald Trump is president and that he won. But those are the QAnon supporters for you out there. But yeah, the nuclear codes thing sort of goes against, well, what I know, we in our liberal bubble thought we were informed over the past 4 years that even the most ardent Trump supporters were like, well, I wish he'd stop flying off the handle on Twitter all the time, right? But, you know, I guess power's power.
Is there an offshoot of QAnon where Donald Trump is secretly still president but just doesn't have the nuclear briefcase?
Well, yeah. I'm not sure about the actual like locale of the nuclear briefcase. I believe that the people who still believe that he is president and will reveal himself on March 4th or March 20th, whatever it is, probably believe that he is still in control of the nuclear football.
Okay. I got you. Now, David, what did we learn from Trump's speech and CPAC generally? Well, we saw the beginning of what the Washington Post Philip Bump called Trump's attempted post-insurrection marketing pitch. So we know what happened in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. Joe Biden became president on January 20th. And now here we are on March 2nd. And this is Trump trying to reintroduce himself post-insurrection. Part of this was the big lie that you mentioned that Donald Trump won the election, that he's still claiming he won. As he spoke on Sunday, members of the crowd chanted, "You won." Who knows, Trump said from the stage, "I might even decide to beat them," meaning the Democrats, "for a third time." Dave Weigel of the Washington Post called CPAC Copechella because everyone was coping with the fact that Donald Trump is not actually the president of the United States.
I mean, the cope, it's a weird way to cope, right? I mean, it's, I mean, coping might be giving him too much of the benefit of the doubt, because it did sort of seem like nobody there was under the impression that he had lost, or at least no one was willing to say it out loud. And I think either way, that's pretty frightening, right? I mean, listen, I will cut somebody the tiniest bit of theoretical slack for not like booing Donald Trump while he's on stage and fallaciously proclaiming that he won the last election. But every speaker, I mean, the entire CPAC seemed to be dedicated to perpetuating, like you said, the big lie. I mean, for continuing on this ridiculous, just totally, well, treasonous line of argument that Trump was the rightful winner of the election, when, you know, I think that, well, I don't think we necessarily all believed that would be over by now, but I think that we were all hoping that would be, you know, those childish things would be left behind in an era of, well, I mean, now that the real president, President Biden, had taken over.
Bump did point out a few things to that line of thought. One is that Trump is kind of trying to nuance his way out of the riot. This was a quote from Sunday. The Democrats use the ... virus as an excuse to change all the election rules without the approval of their state legislatures, making it therefore illegal. It had a massive impact on the election. Now, you see what he's doing there. One, let's just say that's not true. Many of the election laws were passed by Republican legislatures. Many of them were passed long before the coronavirus started. But what he's saying there is he's moving a little bit away from, aha, voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud. He's saying, no, it was these election laws that were changed. Mm-hmm. That's what made it illegal. So my friends had a chance to prove fraud. They couldn't prove anything. Chances to put up before courtrooms dozens of times. They couldn't do it. So I'm now sort of changing the argument. It's not about voter fraud. It's about these election laws, which we therefore must change.
Well, and that is the entire conservative movement obviously mirrored Trump and his sort of, well, apoplexy, idiocy, whatever. I mean, as long as he was insisting that the election was stolen, so did so much of the conservative right-wing machine. But now what you see is really Trump reflecting them back, right? I mean, he sort of adopted the arguments that the last stragglers, the intellectual last stragglers, are making, right? Oh, we were never saying that the election was stolen. We were just saying that, look, there are all these like major grievances that one could raise. And, you know, again, one would think that a single judge somewhere might have agreed with them if there were any shred of truth to it. There's no shred of truth to it, but, you know, it's sort of it's weirdly concrete and abstract at the same time, right? It's like when, you know, gun rights activists try to catch you in a corner for not knowing something about like the magazine of a certain gun or something, and therefore you don't know what you're talking about in the whole issue. It's sort of a disprovable bit of legalese. But anyway, Trump has definitely adopted some of those arguments from, you know, the people who are still making the argument out there publicly.
The other thing he did was try to separate the speech he gave on January 6th from the actual Capitol riot. Like these were two very, very distinct events. This is a quote from Sunday. He gave this to Fox. The press doesn't like to talk about it, but the real number was much, much bigger in terms of people that were at the location. It went all the way back practically to the Washington Monument. It was tremendous numbers of people, not the Capitol. I'm talking about the rally itself. And it was a love fest, he continued. It was a beautiful thing. So you see what he's doing there. Rally and my speech, love fest. Thing that happened at the Capitol, some very separate event. That was not the thing. And notice there, David, he is also once again trying to insist that he had lots and lots of people lined up to hear him around the Capitol. That goes back to the old Sean Spicer days, when it was how many people attended Donald Trump's 2017 inauguration.
Yeah.
A little callback there from Trump. See, that's what they do in quality television shows. You reference things in the expanded universe. That's really Donald Trump telling people. It's like WandaVision, right? That's Donald Trump saying, hey, look, remember that? I had many, many more people at this than you might think, too.
It's sort of like this, the dilution theory of the assault on the Capitol, right? If you can just sort of inflate the crowd size to a certain point, it becomes a really important, a really like effective tool, right? I mean, it's like when, yes. in 2 years, when every congressional race is going to be decided on the fact that all these Republicans voted to acquit Trump the charges of impeachment, and also overlooked the fact that he instigated this riot, they can just be like, well, yeah, sir, all of the Republicans in Congress did vote in favor of Trump, but there are millions and millions of Republicans in the world and in the country, and not all of them voted that way. So you can't really blame us.
We also got a little bit of a glimpse of the post-presidency Trump. He confirmed that he's going to be a Republican, not a third party guy. We already knew that, but that was interesting to hear from his mouth. He decided to go ahead and do this kind of fantasy booking scenario where he's the president. We would have had a deal with Iran in the first week, Trump said of his second term. See, Biden is engaged in this thing with Iran. We would have already had that deal done, he said. Of President Biden on energy. He wants to put you all out of business. He's not okay with energy. He wants windmills, the windmills that don't work when you need them. Reprising a line of argument or a line of bullshit from the snowstorms in Texas. He also took claim for the vaccines, right? Like, if there's anything that drives Donald Trump nuts right now, it is that he will not get credit for the vaccine, which, of course, he was not in a laboratory making. But now that people are being vaccinated in this country at Dodger Stadium and everywhere else, somebody else is getting the credit for that. And he can't stand it.
Remember when Geraldo suggested that we just call the shot to Trump? Not the vaccine, but the act of getting the shot? Like, did you get your Trump? I don't even have a joke. I just remember that. That was great.
That was the ultimate act of giving in. That's like saying Trump's not late. You know, we're just, okay, we'll call the shot the Trump. that was how low we were at that point in history. This miraculous life-saving vaccine. If we just call it the Trump, maybe people will go get it. Ben Jacobs notes, as always, Trump read his text as if large sections were entirely new to him, offering occasional commentary and going off on obscure, meandering riffs, including at one point the statement, quote, "The world is actually a small piece of the universe." Donald Trump going a little Carl Sagan on us there. Billions and billions of stars.
Oh, my God.
We are but small people living in a vast universe.
Oh, and let's not forget that Trump claims that he requested 10,000 National Guard troops at the Capitol on the day of his speech, or the day of the riot, to be clear, but was rejected by Nancy Pelosi. Presumably, this is an easily provable thing that we will find out is not true very soon. But I love the implication, though, that just like he was like, hey, listen, I wanted to control that treasonous riot that I instigated as much as the next guy. The Democrats stopped me from having the guards there to keep my supporters from charging the Capitol as I always wanted. It's fantastic. Boy. It's like a hold me back argument. It's fantastic.
There was a straw poll at CPAC, as there always is, David, because everybody wants to know who is going to be the 2024 GOP candidate for president. And they did it two ways. If you include Trump in the poll, he runs away with 55% of attendees want Donald Trump to be the nominee one more time and bring it all back. If you don't include Donald Trump in the straw poll, things get more interesting. Did you see that the runaway winner with 43% of the vote is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis?
Oh my God.
Was that surprising to you? Ron DeSantis?
Well, can we make... Is there an argument that because of coronavirus that this was a less national travel sort of CPAC, that there was just more of a Florida crowd that would be pro DeSantis? Is that feasible?
Yeah.
I mean, regardless, it's a home turf sort of vote. I don't know. I mean, at a conference where people seemed more than anything else interested in perpetuating the myth that Trump won the election and lauding Trump and any number of other ways, it's not shocking that DeSantis would be amongst the front runners, because he's sort of the most Trump light, or Trump Jr., or Trump whatever you want to say, of the field, right? I mean, the fact that he beat out some of these more establishment candidates, that doesn't shock me. I mean, the degree to which he won is sort of shocking.
Yeah. I just think if we had gone into these Cousin Sal casino 6 months ago and said, which one of these governors' political fortunes will be brightest at the end of the pandemic? Andrew Cuomo, Gavin Newsom, or Ron DeSantis? The odds that it would be Ron DeSantis would be pretty high. And yet here he is, 43% in this admittedly unscientific straw poll. By the way, Ron Paul won the straw poll before, so entertainment purposes only. Let me give you some of the other results, David. Number two on the poll, Kristi Noem of South Dakota, 11%. I had no idea Kristi Noem was interested in becoming president. Don Jr. at 8%. Mike Pompeo, 7%. Really? Really, Mike Pompeo? Come on. Ted Cruz, 7%. Tucker Carlson, Josh Hawley, and Nikki Haley, and Ivanka, all 3%. Rand Paul, 2%. And finally, last and certainly least, at least in this poll, Mike Pence at 1%.
Was that a courtesy one? Was that?
You think one person just like looked at a tote board and didn't see how they didn't have a vote?
Yeah.
It's like that NBA All-Star voting we heard about where, you know, you want to make sure all your teammates get a vote.
Oh, man, that 1%. Now, as long as we're extrapolating wildly, you wonder if like a really bad showing by someone like Pence or maybe some of the other, like I said, more mainstream candidates might show them that hewing to the Trump line is not necessarily the best path forward for them. Certainly, obviously, they will not actually take that as the lesson, but maybe that should be the lesson, right? That like the only way you're going to effectively rally Trump's base is to either be a Trump or be a Trump clone. And, you know, that's not a viable path for just about anybody.
Yeah. I you know, again, it's almost less the question of, is Donald Trump in charge of the GOP is settled law. There's no question he's obviously running the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
The question is just, what do the Republicans do with that? Like, how in the world do you navigate that? And how could you possibly come out of that and be the GOP nominee, not tie yourself in knots like Nikki Haley's done over the last couple of months? How do you figure out a way from here to the 2024 nomination? And I don't know, right? I don't think anybody knows. But Ron DeSantis, that was wild. Speaking of Donald Trump being back, David, this weekend also brought back one amazing tradition of the Trump years. Ted Cruz was asked to comment on Donald Trump's speech at CPAC. And Ted Cruz said, I didn't see them. He did not see the speech. Remember when all those Republican senators didn't see the tweet? He didn't see the speech.
That's unbelievable. Why were you there? I mean, I know he went on late, but come on. I can't imagine you were too busy handing out water in parking lots to do that. By the way, did you see Ted Cruz's speech?
I did. I'm going to be honest.
It was really like just really bad comedy about coronavirus regulations. Right?
I did see the Cancun joke that he made at the beginning.
Yeah,
and that was supposed to be self-deprecating.
He went on to have a very odd riff. It was like a joke without a punchline. It was an odd riff about how silly it was that you had to wear your mask when you walked into the restaurant, but then you could take it off when you sat down. It's like, I mean, it was just bad. It was somebody who doesn't get out much, who like watches, you know, stand-up comedy specials on Netflix and thinks they could do that. It was just really, really embarrassing.
I could totally see Ted Cruz watching the blue collar comedy special and being like, I could do that. I could be one of those guys. Just with a little practice. I decided to go into politics. A little practice. I could be that good.
He's 100. It's not even blue collar. He's 100% watching like George Carlin and just being like, see, the woke police would never let this happen today. And just like, tossing popcorn down his gullet. That's Ted Cruz.
When I say I didn't see Ted Cruz's speech at CPAC, I'm not like being like one of those senators. I really did not want to watch that. I willfully was not going to watch that. And by the way, we got a pretty good overworked Twitter joke going when Cruz said he didn't see Trump's speech. If only Neera Tanden had live tweeted Trump's speech, then maybe Ted Cruz would have seen it. Speaking of which, David, time for the overworked Twitter joke of the week, where we celebrate a gag that was so obvious that all of media Twitter made it at exactly the same time. Send your nominees to @ThePressBoxPod. where they are always gratefully received. One final scene from CPAC, David. According to journalist William Turton, attendees lined up to get their pictures taken with Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Mm-hmm.
Marjorie Taylor Greene. It was an overworked Twitter joke, or maybe just a good joke to write. Why on God's green earth would you say they're lining up instead of saying they're in the queue? In the queue. Thanks to Tim Moran for that one. Last night was the Zoom call version of the Golden Globes. David, you might have seen some content here on The Ringer. Daniel Kaluuya won a Best Supporting Actor Award for Judas and the Black Messiah. One problem. Due to an audio glitch, we could not hear the first part of his acceptance speech. It was an overworked Twitter joke to write, Daniel, you're on mute. Thanks to Jordan A. Shafiat for that one. And finally, a tweet that's good news for people like me and David. Quoting here, glasses wearers less likely to get COVID, study says. Glasses wearers less likely to get COVID. It was an overworked Twitter joke to write, nerd immunity. Thanks to Scott Clayton, Benjamin Scott, and Corbin Dubois, or Dubois. Do you remember when we used to live together, mid-2000s, and like you'd peek into my room on a Sunday afternoon, I'd be just reading a book, and you'd be like, what are you doing? And I'd be like, I'm just reading a book, and you'd just go, nerd.
Yeah.
I always loved that.
Yeah, well, I am allowed to make fun of nerds because I'm also a nerd. That's the way that comedy works.
If you stole David's bit, congrats. You made the overworked Twitter joke of the week.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by NetSuite by Oracle. The less your business spends, the more margin of money you have. I think that's pretty obvious for everyone, but actually doing it, that's easier said than done because the cost of everything is going up these days. So do the smart thing. Switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth so you can easily reduce costs and headaches. NetSuite specifically helps by reducing IT costs since it lives in the cloud with no hardware required and cutting the costs of maintaining multiple systems since everything you need is on one suite. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. See for yourself how effective NetSuite can be and try it out today. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/ringer. That is netsuite.com/ringer.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Time for ye olde notebook dump. And David, we have entered a new stage of the coronavirus pandemic. The celebrity author coronavirus book stage. Announcements over the last few weeks caught our eye. Michael Lewis is writing a coronavirus book called The Premonition, a pandemic story, which is out May 4th. And Lawrence Wright of The New Yorker has a book called The Plague Year, which is out 1 month later, June 8th. So you're our publishing guy here. Let's back up before we even get to the celebrity nonfiction author portion of this. When something like the coronavirus is happening, obviously a huge story, obviously an occasion for books, what is going on inside a book publishing house? Are they immediately thinking, we need to have books about this and we need to get them out? Are they waiting for pitches, which are going to be inevitable? How does that work?
Both. All of the above, I guess. There's certainly, Lawrence Wright, Michael Lewis, writers of that level have a little bit more latitude to write on a certain schedule or to, you know, let their creative juices flow however they may flow. But their agents presumably are leaping into action the moment there is even the inkling that a book might exist at some point in the future, to sort of gauge the writer's interest to see if they'd want to do it. And they can, I mean, you could sell, well, both of them are probably under an option contract with a publisher. I mean, maybe, maybe not, but there's, you know, Michael Lewis's last publisher probably has an option on whatever he does next. But regardless, you could sell a Michael Lewis book or write book with, you know, a sentence, you know, just Michael Lewis on the pandemic. We will give you $5 million for that tomorrow. You know, I mean, that part's pretty easy. And that's, but I mean, I'm sure there are literally tens, if not 100 other related books that are in the pipeline from authors you've never heard of, or just kind of mid-list authors or other big name authors. But those sort of, you know, a name as big as, well, Michael Lewis or Lawrence Wright. I mean, but Michael Lewis in particular will succeed kind of regardless of genre, but will also at the same time eclipse a lot of other books in the genre. So a little bit of a division killer, that one.
Now, the coronavirus. This is something that's obviously a huge news story. Do book publishers regard that as like, this is something people will definitely want to read about, will not be able to get enough books about? Or is this something that's so sort of depressing and has affected our lives so much that there may be less of an appetite to read a book about that?
I'm tempted to say it's too depressing, although I think the logic will eventually push against that, because the publishing logic, because, well, I mean, this is a totally different example, but like, if you have the book that if you're the publisher of The Da Vinci Code, when The Da Vinci Code comes out, you're going to sell a trillion extra copies of The Da Vinci Code, even, you know, obviously it's a blockbuster, whatever. But also, if you're the publisher of like an art flick that may get nominated for like one Oscar but doesn't win it, and like even you or I might not see this movie, you're still going to make a lot of money off of that book, because the scale of like movie viewership versus book viewership is so different.
Mm-hmm.
The point I'm trying to make is, yeah, you or I or everybody might say, it's too depressing to read about the coronavirus, but there's going to be just so much abstract interest in the coronavirus compared to another popular science book that the coronavirus is probably a safer field, like area to publish into. And could certainly, you know, take off. Now, you would think that there would be, there's different sorts of books, right? If we weren't talking about Michael Lewis anyway, I would be sitting here saying, there's a lot more upside in a Michael Lewis style book about the coronavirus than, you know, a dry sort of journalistic recounting of something, right? If you can find a way to tell a story that's exciting, almost regardless of whether or not it's about the coronavirus, then sure, tell me. I mean, publish those all day. And there are some that are going to break news and they're going to be important, you know, pieces of history. But it is a depressing area to publish into. I will be intrigued to see how many COVID books there are on the front table of the bookstore, you know, in 6 months or a year.
So you mentioned, David, Michael Lewis and Lawrence Wright can basically sell a book based on a sentence. What other kind of things are afforded to big nonfiction authors like that, mega selling nonfiction authors, that wouldn't be afforded to normal authors?
I mean, and so the people, I mean, there's many, I mean, all the way down to like, you know, royalty percentages and stuff like that. But although less than, you know, once was the case. But I mean, we talked about, you know, how many books are going to be published in the subject and everything. I mean, the specter of a book by Michael Lewis or Lawrence Wright is not just like theoretically push other books aside, but literally, I mean, the buyer of the Barnes & Noble is going to say, oh, we have a Michael Lewis book on the subject coming out that month, so we want zero copy or one copy of your book as opposed to 1,000 if it had come out a month earlier. You know, I mean, so mm-hmm. they don't need to make room for anybody. Everybody else has got to make room for them. And you know, they'll get the full more, it is more likely than with, you know, another writer that they'll get the full strength of the publishing machine behind them, you know, obviously PR and marketing also. I mean, but even as on the pre-pub side. I mean, people always talk about how books don't have fact checkers. I mean, presumably if Michael Lewis said, I want a fact checker, that someone would provide one, right? I mean, you have a lot of power you can throw around. So, but you know, I mean, it's, I don't think anything too shocking. They've earned their spots, you know, and these books will probably be great. Well, we've already read have we read all of Lawrence Wright's book, or is he fleshing out the New Yorker piece?
I would assume that's not the whole thing, right?
I mean, it's very, very long. I would assume so too. But we kind of know what that one's going to be. Michael Lewis, I'm looking right now on BarnesandNoble.com. It's apparently a taut and brilliant nonfiction thriller that pits a band of medical visionaries against the wall of ignorance. That was the official response of the Trump administration to the outbreak of COVID-19. So yes, we found our way in now.
Yeah.
Can they find their way out?
And even just from the press materials, like you can already tell it's Michael Lewis, that a 13-year-old girl's science project on transmission of an airborne pathogen develops into a very grown-up model of disease control. A local public health officer uses her worm's eye view, .. Right? We can see the kind of heroes you didn't know about that Michael Lewis found that will tell us the story of this very complex, overwhelming thing in very human terms,
mm-hmm.
right? That's his gift. That's what he does. You mentioned the stuff like the Barnes & Noble orders the book. I love just being somebody who's on the mailing lists of these from these publishers who gets a like separate email to announce a book. Like if you have a certain status in the book world, the publisher just doesn't send me the catalog with the book in it. They say, Lawrence Wright is writing a book. Right. You should know about that. And sometimes even they get like Michael Lewis, the fact that Michael Lewis is writing a book about the coronavirus got an article in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
Just to tell us, doesn't even tell us what's in the book. It just says Michael Lewis is writing a book about the coronavirus. That's like the level you have attained at that point where it's like, it's news that you're writing something in the New York Times and not a blurb either, like a full blown news article. And I'm not criticizing because when I got the paper that day, that was like the first thing I read. I was
exactly.
like, oh, cool.
Yes.
Michael Lewis is writing this. Can we get him on the press box? So you think there's going to be, you think if we walk into the bookstore in 6 months or a year, we'll see more than a dozen books about the coronavirus? Two dozen?
Well, C is the question, right? If you're looking for them, yeah, you'll find many, many books about it. I mean, and there'll be scholarly books, you know, there'll be like I said, journalistic books. There'll be there's so many different varieties of books. Of ways that you could publish that. But I do think that every publisher, almost every single publisher, serious publisher, will have a book on the subject, whether or not they have the biggest name on, and it'll be to some extent, you know, like Trump books, you know, or like how many more could the market possibly hold? Well, I mean, they keep coming out, right? So I think that we will see a lot of them. Yeah,
the story's so big too. There's all kinds of books you can write about it. I mean, these are books that sort of take on the pandemic. And sort of how do we fix it? How do we solve this problem? How do we rescue human society? But there's also books like I saw a book about the NBA bubble that was a sign that was mm-hmm. sold last year. Like it's such a vast story that you can write books about all kinds of parts of it and have them be totally self-contained and different from the other ones.
It's true. I mean, and good bookstores are already, I mean, it's not like we're waiting for this wave to come. The good bookstores are already selling, I'm sure, huge numbers of copies of like The Hot Zone and of the Defoe book, the Journal of the Plague Year. And I mean, all these books about the bubonic plague that have sort of popular histories that have been published over the past decade have been, you know, those are books that people are very interested in right now. So that's sort of the tip of the tip of the wave, I guess. And there'll be many more to come.
All right. David and I will be reading these and you will be hearing these celebrity authors with any luck here on the Press Box Podcast. All right, it's time for David Shoemaker Guesses the Strained Pun Headline.
Yeah.
Thursday's headline about a troupe of homebound pandemic family singers was Von Trapped. I've been sitting on today's headline for a while. It comes from Simon Pollock. It's from Celtic's blog. The article published before Boston's recent swoon, David, is about the Celtics trying a lineup with both Daniel Tice and Robert Williams on the floor at the same time. We're both big men. Your hint here is Shakespeare. Shakespeare. What was Celtic's blog's strained pun headline?
Shakespeare.
This could have run on The Ringer, by the way. So this is so
is two ships passing in the night Shakespeare?
You got the wrong guy, as Angus King once said.
I thought it was going to be like two stiffs passing in the night or so. What would be the,
no offense to Daniel Tyson, Robert Williams. This is elemental Tice. Shakespeare. What is one Shakespeare quote that everyone knows?
To be or not to be? Two bigs or not two bigs?
Yeah, two bigs, too big or not too big.
T-O-O? Too big?
No. Two, because there's two of them on the floor at the same time. Too big.
Wow.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty good. He is David Shoemaker. I'm Brian Curtis. Production magic by Erica Cervantes. We are back Thursday with more Lukewarm Takes About the Media. See you then, David.
See you later, Brian.